Oh, you don't want me to touch it.
You saw me wanting to touch it.
All right. Okay, so these are the final two sessions for the symposium today. And we're going to have, the first session is going to be hatcheries and salmon. And it's a mini session with Andy is going to be presenting. And then following that, we're going to have a session on barriers to fish movement. So with that, I'll introduce Andy Wysick from Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association, who's been a longtime partner with the Matsu Salmon Symposium. And he's going to be talking to us about the role of hatchery programs in conserving Susitna salmon stocks. So please give him your attention.
All right. Like Erica said, I'm Andy Wysick with Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association. And CIA has been working now in South Central Alaska for 40 years, so it's kind of a celebration year for us, our 40-year anniversary, helping to preserve salmon and their habitats in and around Cook Inlet. I wanted to come here today to highlight some of the work we've done in the Matsu, but the main thing that I want you to take away from this talk is that we're here to help. We know that our mission to protect self-perpetuating salmon stocks and rehabilitate impaired salmon habitats can't happen in a vacuum. So I want to extend an invitation to anyone working in the Matsu on salmon issues to ask me if you have data gaps we can help fill, if there's opportunities we can share flights in the field. Basically, anything we can do to work with this partnership to help us all get more done to benefit salmon, we will try to do. So I think we've had a few busy slides today, and I know this slide's pretty busy, but I wanted to highlight some of the many projects we've worked on over the years in the Matsu. Our executive director, Gary, was quick to point out that I missed a few here, but I think there's a text box limit in PowerPoint, so we ended it there. From habitat and invasive species work to surveys, salmon enumeration and enhancement, we've been committed over the years to keeping the Susitna salmon's populations thriving and sustainable. So the slide's busy because we've been busy. This seems to be a popular theme for slides this year, and I suppose the problems salmon face in the Matsu won't come as a surprise to anybody in this room. A quick internet search brings up hundreds of articles, warming streams, disease, overhanging culverts, invasive pike, and Elodia, just to name a few. Shell Lake is a place with some of these issues too. I skipped ahead a slide there. I've got a mismatch on the computer here. There we are. So Shell Lake is a place with some of these issues too, so I'd like to talk about what we've been doing out there and hopefully spark some interest from you or even give you some ideas about how our work out there could help yours. So Shell Lake is located just west of the confluence of the Yentna and Skwentna rivers, about 75 miles northwest, or west-northwest of where we are right now. There's a lot of land in between Shell and Kenai, and we fly it quite often, so if anybody here has projects on that general path, it'd be a great idea to come talk to me, and maybe we can talk about sharing flights. I know how travel budgets are going with most people, so that's one area we could probably help out. Since 2006, we've been enumerating juvenile and adult salmon at Shell Lake and also collecting environmental data. Since 2012, we've included the aggressive harvest northern pike as part of an attempt to rehabilitate this impaired salmon stock. So when I say impaired salmon stock, this is what I'm talking about. Over the past decade, sockeye returns to Shell Lake have dropped dramatically. While Shell Creek does not have any overhanging culverts or Elodia, the habitat does face many of the challenges that we've discussed in previous talks and in previous slides. Since we've been working at Shell, we've identified three major obstacles to returning it to sustainable sockeye production: northern pike, beaver dams, and disease. So now I want to go into a bit more detail with these individual challenges and present our current approach for facing them. So, northern pike. Because of the direct impact pike are having on juvenile salmon through predation, this is currently the most pressing concern at Shell Lake. Since we began netting pike, we have removed over 3,500 and collected data for weight, sex, length, and stomach contents. We also wanted to determine what effects this aggressive removal is having on pike population structure at Shell, so we can determine if this is the best course of action when dealing with invasive pike. With this in mind, we've begun to collaborate with Peter Wesley from UAF, and along with Jeff, and they'll be delving into some of our data set to start trying to answer questions about the population structure, facing netting, and some other questions he has about pike. It's our hope that success at Shell Lake can provide a model for success at other affected lakes throughout the Mat-Su. At the very least, we want to be sure that we are using best practices in combating invasive pike and aren't doing anything that would exacerbate the problem. Again, if you're interested in pike and their relationship to salmon, I usually have a good supply of dead pike laying around if you'd like to study them. I'd also be happy to discuss any data that you think we should be collecting that we aren't currently gathering. And for anybody interested in catching and working up pike, please don't hesitate to contact me. I'd be more than happy to show people how we go about killing pike or hear any tips that you have or fish stories. So the second factor at Shell Creek is beaver dams, and these can present fish passage issues as well when the conditions are right. Each August, CIAA serves several systems in the Mat-Su for beaver dams, including Shell Creek. When beaver dams are located, there are a couple criteria that must be met in order for us to take any action to modify the dam. First, there must be fish impounded below the dam. It's not worth the effort to notch a dam if there aren't fish ready to swim up the river. Second, the dam has to be too high for the fish to jump it on their own. Not all beaver dams will block salmon. If there's a hole deep enough below the dam to allow the fish a place to get oriented to jump, they may be able to clear it on their own. And the third thing is weather and stream conditions. Dams are more likely to cause problems during hot, dry years, and if rain's coming in the forecast, it's not really worth the expense of doing any modification. So another thing I want to note here is that we are sensitive to the positive roles that beavers play in the ecosystem. We never completely remove beaver dams or kill beavers because we know they serve several crucial functions like providing juvenile rearing habitat and flood protection. When we find a dam that's blocking salmon, our staff open up a notch, probably about 3 feet wide, and provide the fish below a chance to pass. The dams are generally repaired within 24 hours by the beavers and remain mostly intact throughout the entire process, so they continue to offer all the benefits to the ecosystem. Another benefit to notching is that a jumping hole forms underneath the area of the notch dam, and this provides salmon with a better chance of clearing the dam even after it's been repaired. So beaver dam surveys are another area where we'd like to help out, but we would also like to ask for your help. If you know of a system that's got problems with beavers blocking salmon passage, let us know about it. Also, if you want to study more about the effects of notching dams versus other methods, I'm in for that as well. So, third challenge at Shell Lake has been disease. Like many populations of sockeye, Shell Lake sockeye have endemic diseases that may or may not present clinical symptoms. Sockeye returns to Shell Lake from previous years were marked by pre-spawn mortalities on the spawning grounds, and our staff subsequently submitted samples from the dying fish to the ADF&G pathology lab. The lab indicated there were several known pathogens present in the samples, and they all may have contributed to those pre-spawning mortalities. The main pathogen thought to be the cause of most of the mortalities being Loma salmonae, which had caused visible lesions on the gills of these fish and respiratory distress. Loam infestations can persist in wild populations in part because emergent fry ingest the spores of the parasites from the carcasses of dead adults on the spawning grounds. So this brings me to perhaps the most vital role that we play, that Cook Inlet Aquaculture can play in the fight for Matsu salmon, which is the recovery of populations from the brink of extirpation through the use of our hatcheries. Or maybe a better way to say that is the preservation of genetic diversity through use of our hatcheries. In 2012, CIAA received approval to take eggs from Shell Lake Sockeye, and those 80,000 eggs were raised at our Trail Lakes hatchery and released in 2014 as smolt. The first return of sockeye from that egg take came back this year, and we were able to collect another 90,000 eggs. So as it turns out, 2012 was the last year that natural production provided enough fish back to Shell to be adequate enough to provide for an egg take. Without that egg take, we most likely would have lost the Shell Lake sockeye stock for good. So rearing sockeye in the hatchery can buy salmon some time as we work to solve some of the habitat issues in the Matsu, and I want to highlight some of the additional benefits provided in the fight against some of the other issues facing Shell Lake sockeye. First of all our eggs are screened for disease, and the resulting fry aren't subjected to the diseases present in the lake during the rearing phase of development. The hatchery-produced sockeye that returned to Shell Lake this year showed lower overall disease symptoms. We didn't have any fish dying on the spawning grounds, so this seems to be working. We're waiting on pathology results from this year's fish, so we can't say that 100%. The second thing is that the eggs we take experience a much higher rate of survival compared to wild spawn fish. And when you're looking at low populations of fish, over 90% of the eggs that we took in 2012 made it to the smolt stage. So you compare that to 1 to 20% of survival that's regularly the case in wild spawn fish. And you can see the benefits there. The juvenile salmon are also granted a reprieve from pike predation prior to migration. So as we're working on this pike problem, the hatcheries are also playing a role in that. So I want to point out something that I think has been kind of a common theme throughout the day, and when Dr. Schindler brought that up, it actually kind of made my heart beat a little bit because I was like, oh, that's perfect segue into this. And that's that the genetic diversity of the greater Susitna watershed is only as strong as the number of distinct genetic stocks within the watershed. When one of those genetic stocks is lost, it lessens the genetic diversity of the whole watershed and decreases the resilience of the Susitna salmon population. In that light, I want to note that no salmon-producing lakes in the Susitna are insignificant. All of the stocks that make up the salmon run are pieces of a puzzle that together make the system functional and resilient. As I stated earlier, the goal of this project is to return Shell Lake to natural, sustainable production. Hatchery production is buying Shell Lake sockeye time until more permanent solutions to invasive pike issues can be discovered. It also has the potential to break the disease cycle, and in the meantime, it is providing a critical conservation role by preserving the genetics of Shell Lake sockeye. So while my main focus is on salmon habitats and field work, without the hatchery component of this project, we would most likely not have any salmon left to protect on the Shell Lake. So since it's our 40th year, do I have time before questions to show a short video? Okay, so I can't pop it on really quick? Oh, we're so excited about this video. So this shows some of our sites that are kind of beyond the Matsu, and it's something you guys probably don't get to see very often. But we are proud of the work we do, and just wanted to let this video run for a little bit. So if anybody has any questions, they can ask me maybe afterwards. Before I get off here, I wanted to take a second to thank the Matsu Fish and Wildlife Commission and the Matsu Borough for helping with funding for Shell Lake, and also the AKSSF for some past and actually future funding that's coming to Shell Lake. So thank you.
There's my question.
Okay, now we're at the Barriers to Fish Movement session, and our first speaker is going to be Jillian O'Doherty with ADF&G on updates to fish passage barriers in Matsu.
Hi, everyone. I am the Fish Passage Improvement Program Coordinator at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and I'm giving a talk today just on the status update on fish passage barriers in the Matsu Borough. There's been a very active program of fish passage barrier removal and replacement for 16 or 17 years now in the borough. So this is a talk I think that Bill Rice has typically given in the past. So hopefully I'm not repeating too much of what he said last year. But these are just some pictures of a few of the projects that we've worked on with different partners. And PowerPoint 8, all the logos. So I'm going to apologize for that up front to all the partners who are in the room. So there's been a few phases of fish passage work in the Matsu Borough. Prior to about 2008, it was fairly opportunistic. They had some assessment work. The borough did some in 2004. We had some earlier assessment work from Fish and Game. There was a lot of dirt to paving projects going on at the time, and the idea, I think, was really to try to take advantage of that and replace as many culverts as possible while the roads were still dirt. There was kind of a top 30 list that various partners had come up with, Nature Conservancy, Fish and Wildlife Service, the borough. It concentrated on road service areas. They concentrated on trying to do every barrier on small stream systems. There was a number of private landowners that worked with these partners also. And again, it was fairly opportunistic. There was a prioritization done by the Nature Conservancy, I believe. And the idea was basically to find the kind of reddest of the red, the worst culverts. And we used these priority criteria, emphasizing existing AWC data and kind of level of blockage. And again, this is all for the culverts that had been assessed and were kind of known at this time. Then between 2009 and 2011, when I started Fish and Game, we did a three-year assessment project that kind of encompassed the entire Matsu Borough. And that's all of the data that's available on our mapper that I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with. And our goal was really to look at every single road crossing on every single fish-bearing or potentially fish-bearing stream in the entire borough. And we did pretty well with that. At the end of 2011, I believe we had basically seen everything on the public roads that we could find, and we had done about two-thirds of the railroad sites. And our process is essentially assess every single site we come across. We used maps, we located sites that way, and then we just drove every road and looked for crossings. We assessed them all with a standard protocol. The additional assessments to address dray culverts are something that's kind of happened on a site-by-site basis. And then we took that data, which again is all up on our mapper, and we use it to identify and prioritize barriers for replacement. So this is the five-second summary of our assessment levels. Basically green, we think it passes juvenile and adult fish. Gray, it's kind of iffy. Red, we don't think it passes juvenile fish. And again, in the Matsu, we concentrated very heavily on juvenile fish. There's about 570 culverts, and there's really only about 20 of them that were significant barriers to adult fish in that they just blocked adult fish passage. So these pictures are fairly typical of our kind of red culverts. There's a lot of these, if I can do this right, these sites that have multiple culverts. And the reason they did that was essentially they had a stream that was X feet wide, and they had a series of culverts that were X, you know, divided by 5 feet wide, so they just put five of them in a row. And they do pass the water fairly effectively. They're extremely problematic for fish. They're still undersized. The flow obviously never goes through the multiple culverts evenly. You get these accelerated flows, you get scour. This is pretty typical where the pipes will have either failed or just put in at different heights. So you get a lot of debris blockage. you know, you get all of the flow basically going through one or two pipes rather than all five. So they don't actually look that bad, but they are pretty significant barriers to juvenile fish. Again, this is our red, gray, green classification. It's based on juvenile salmonids. We do have kind of a separate prioritization for adults. It's fairly small. We look at things like culvert type, the slope of the culvert, whether there's substrate in it, the perch height, how much the river or the flow is constricted to fit through that pipe. And all of that information is based off like hydrological modeling of a typical fish with a typical ability to swim passing through a site. Then there's other factors in the field. You know, there's damage to the site. There's backwatered sites in these sloughs. We have fish ladders at a few culverts in the Mat-Su, tidal influence. So we have a manual. It's available on the Fishing Game, the Fish Passage website, that outlines in excruciating detail how we do all this. And we have essentially done it the same way since 2009 at thousands of sites. So this is, I really apologize for this terrible slide that no one can read, but this is the results from the 2009 to 2011. This is our rating. So we had about half the culverts were rated as red, again for juvenile fish. About 20% were gray, about 30% were green, and this black category is just, we can't really rate it. So a lot of times it's either safety concern or the whole thing is like caved in and we can't even measure it. So what was interesting to us was looking at the factors, the major factors that affect fish passage in the Mat-Su. Oops. So the main things we saw were this gradient red. That means it's too steep. So for juvenile fish, if you have a bare metal pipe with any amount of flow going through it, if it's more than about 2 or 3% sustained slope, the water velocities will be high enough that those little young adair fish won't be able to get through it. And again, a lot of that was based on modeling and also some lab studies, and we just completed a study actually looking at that in the field with wild fish. We also saw the second most common issue was basically damage. A lot of these pipes are really old. They were put in on subdivision roads without a lot of oversight. There's a very significant issue with stuff just kind of falling apart. We had this outfall height red. Anything that's above about sort of 4 or 5 inches is fairly difficult for a small fish to jump into. A culvert differs from a natural barrier in that when a fish jumps a natural barrier, it typically lands in a little bit of a pool. It lands with its belly and its tail in the water and it can swim away. When they jump into a culvert, they're landing on a hard metal surface in very shallow, fast-flowing water. So they tend to just go back out again. So again, these are kind of what we saw. We had, you know, our second one was mechanical problems. Condition rating was very low. Culverts were undersized. They were a little bit steep. Kind of a conglomeration of issues. This is the distribution from that report. So we had pretty well distributed throughout the borough we had issues. And at this point, most of the work had been done kind of here in the core area, and especially around the Little Sioux tributaries. So this would have been 2011. We took that data and we did a prioritization, and we've done dozens of these prioritizations using this data over the past 7 years because you can't see this again, which I apologize for. But essentially, we have our site ID, road name, stream name, this kind of prioritization score, which is essentially a measure of some metrics associated with that culvert relative to all the rest of the culverts in our data set. So how many more miles are upstream of this culvert relative to the others? How many more species of salmon are in this system relative to the others, et cetera? And we can weight this. We can, our most typical one is we look at the habitat upstream is about 65% of the score. Salmonid species are about 25. Lakes are about 15. For other species are 10. We can weight it however people want. We can just look at Chinook systems. We can just look at systems with trout. You know, so we've literally produced, I've produced dozens of these for people who've called me up and asked me for them over the years. And a lot of the fish passage that gets done in the borough is done with different partners. So we'll sit down, for example, we sit down with the Mat-Su borough essentially every fall with a freshly run one of these, and we look at which sites we want to work on. So to date, in our database, we have 86 completed projects in the Mat-Su borough, and I'm just tracking the ones that have actually had grant funds expended on them. There have certainly been projects where road owners, et cetera, have gone out and done them. This is the difference to date. 2011, 2016. You can see we have three more sites in the database. That's because we finally got, thanks to the Fish and Wildlife Commission, got out and surveyed on the railroad. We're having a slight movement of green to red. It's not a huge movement percentage-wise, but this next graphic, so this is 2011 to 16. The next graphic I'm going to show you is 2000 to 2015. This is one Bill Rice put together. And that's the number of miles upstream of barriers. So even though it's, you know, we've really made a big effort to target significant barriers to significant mileage upstream on these systems. So you can see there's been a pretty significant change there over the years. And out of what's left, so I'm using mileage, upstream miles, for a lot of our data. However, our upstream miles were basically calculated from maps and aerials prior to us getting the new flow data. So what I did instead for this talk, this is stream width at the crossing, which I'm kind of using as a surrogate of upstream. The largest dots on here are greater than 20 feet. The second one is 10 to 15, 5 to 10, 2 to 5, and less than 2. So we have 106 red culverts left in the borough that are on streams that are less than 2 feet wide. We only have 12 that are on streams that are greater than 10 feet wide. So that's kind of what our prioritization has allowed us to do, is to target those. What's next? We just got the new flow lines and flow data this summer, and we went out this fall and did some fish work and some ground truthing on that. So we're going to incorporate all of that and recalculate our prioritizations and keep working with our partners. Hoping to work with some additional landowners. We've never done any projects in the city of Houston, for example. The Parks Highway upgrade is going on right now, which is an opportunity to, some of these bigger red barriers that are left are on the Parks Highway. And Fish and Game has been working for years now with DOT on those. We are working on an optimization model using the new flow data, which will essentially allow us to look at every, sort of for a given amount of money, we can look at every single combination of culvert removals in the valley, and it'll just pop out what our best bang for the buck is, given particular species, particular amount of money. One other thing we'd like to do at Fish and Game is we have almost 100 of these projects between private and public land. We'd like to do some kind of formal review of them, especially ones that have been through a 100 or a 500-year flood event. And we work every year to refine the data set. We probably make 20 or 30 changes a year in the MATSU just from, you know, folks reporting to us. Our kind of challenges, I think, ongoing for the MATSU borough are essentially, continuing to find funding for the projects. You know, we've got amazing partners. We've had wonderful support from the public. We've done a lot of projects, but a lot of these are grant-funded. We have to keep applying for grants. We have to keep getting funding. The prioritization, the optimization model, we have the same issue as everybody with data. Our biggest data issue is often, do fish use this system? How is good quality is the habitat compared to this other system? Mark Eisman, my colleague, who's not here today, actually just completed a study where we looked at every single system we didn't already have fish data for and did a lot of fish sampling. We are getting into this fewer, larger projects. This is up on the Denali Highway. I mean, that's a really, really significant engineering project there. We're also getting into pipe. This is Trapper Creek at the Parks Highway. That's the highest priority in every prioritization I've ever done. There's 35 miles of upstream habitat. Doesn't really pass juvenile fish. However, do we really want to, nobody wants to touch it. We don't want pike to get up above it. So that's a challenge to some of our kind of fish passage goals, is making sure we don't make the habitat worse. That's our mapper. You guys probably all know where it is. If you don't, ask me afterwards. And yeah, sorry for going over. That's a really good question, and, you know, it would take a lot of money to actually answer that in great detail. Fish and Wildlife Service have done some work to help us refine our prioritizations looking at fish usage. We have done very significant amount of fish sampling over the years as part of the fish passage program. But, I mean, it's habitat that's available to fish. It's in systems that fish are already using. So I think we just have to, you know, kind of make the assumption that it's mostly going to be used by fish. But we don't have a way to say how many more fish we're making.
You don't have the data to verify it.
Yeah. It would be more costly to collect that data than it would be to collect, you know, just replace every barrier in the Matsu, I think. So.
Is it ever possible to do work in stream above and below, say, a culvert, to improve that, or does it just have to be removed?
You're talking about, like, step pools and that type of thing? No, I mean, this picture of Trapper Creek, those step pools have been in there since the 80s. It is possible to build them. When I worked in California, we built a lot more of them. They do have a lifespan. It's sort of 15 years is the design life. And it really depends on the system. If there's a lot of flow or a lot of debris, they'll get destroyed quicker. So we just finished a pit tagging study on Buddy Creek where we had antennas above and below a culvert for 4 years, and halfway through we replaced the culvert. And yeah, I mean, we have seen a lot more fish moving upstream since we replaced the culvert because it was not a total barrier but a fairly significant barrier. And we've also seen a huge difference in the fish, the number of fish and the species that we capture sampling once a week for 4 years with the changes in flow. Yeah, having kind of done an analysis on this in the past, you really need about 10 years of before and about 10 years of after data to make a statistically significant determination, which is a high barrier. But if anybody wants to do it, I will write you a really nice letter for your grant proposal. So the Alaska Railroad is in the 2016 figures. So the overall number went up by 3, and we took a lot of sites out because we found out there were no fish. We walked a lot of streams, and we found waterfalls and things like that. But we added about, a significant number of sites on the railroad, and we have a final draft report on that. It should be out very soon.
Okay, great. All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Will be Brad Micklejohn, who's going to update us on the Kootenai Dam removal. So come on up, Brad.
Thank you.
Thank you for the conservation.
Before I forget, there are project sheets in the back near the entrance on the table if you want to know more about it. So last year, we promised you we were going to start taking this dam out, and this year we're doing it. And near as I know, this is the fastest moving large dam removal project in the nation. 2 years from conception to implementation, which is light speed when you look at some of the major dam removals across the country. There are two major reasons for that fact that it's gone so well. One is it's been privately funded by the Conservation Fund, and the second is that restoration is a very positive form of work, and I think right now we all need really positive forms of work. Just to refresh you on the project, I did talk about this last year, but I'll give an overview to get you oriented. If you drove up from Anchorage, you drove across the remnants of the Eklutna River. That's not really the Eklutna River. The Eklutna River comes out in the wrong place thanks to a power project that dumps the Eklutna into the Knik River. But this is looking up the Eklutna River Valley, the Eklutna Village in the foreground, the Glen Highway and railroad there embedded in the trees. And Lee Stefan and the folks from Occlutna to talk about the shock and awe that their village has experienced in the past 100 years. And that includes this dam on the river that bears their name. The village was there in large part because of the fish that used to be in the Occlutna River. They've also had railroads, highways, kids shipped off to tribal schools, and this dam blocking the Occlutna River. No one asked them. This dam sits down in about a 400-foot deep canyon, very difficult site to access, but as the project has progressed, it's become easier for us to work in the site. The project cost is $7 million. The Conservation Fund has committed $6 million of our money to the project. We're currently actively raising the remaining money. We've so far employed at least 30 people, and we're working with the Occlutna Native Corporation. They have a construction subsidiary that's competent and very highly motivated to do this work. So I think it's a really neat part of the story that the Occlutna people are helping to put their river back together. If you drove down the Glen Highway in September and looked off to your right driving north, you saw this huge yellow thing sticking up into the air. My first reaction was, oh God, I hope the planes don't hit it. It's the largest crane in Alaska. It's 400 feet tall. It took 40 truckloads to install this crane, 40 tractor trailer truckloads. It took them a week to install the crane. The crane's been used to lower a D6 and a backhoe and several other major pieces of equipment down into the canyon. You can also see there in the middle of the picture a staircase going down into the canyon. It's 330 steps long. It was built by the guys who make the dip nets down in Kenai. Mike's Welding built this really cool staircase. It's quite a piece of work, and we've been giving regular tours and be happy to show people this really cool spot. So as I said, the crane's been used to prepare the site. There was a site excavated for the crane pad. The crane itself has 1 million pounds of ballast. Again, the crane boom is 400 feet tall. Really quite striking. The pad that you see there in the bottom was cleared by the equipment that was put in with the crane. So that's a helicopter pad down in the canyon that was cleared with the D6 and the backhoe that were lowered into the canyon. What we're looking straight down onto the dam is just to the left of the boom. What we're looking at is the sediment wedge that's built up behind this dam since the dam was abandoned in the 1950s, and a major issue in this project is sediment management. So this is a schematic of how the project is going to unfold. One of the big issues is safety working in this site. They're going to have to dewater the canyon, move the water around the dam to create a safe working environment so they can get to the base of the dam. The dam itself is 70 feet tall, and there's a wall of sediment that they have to work their way down. The dam's going to get taken down in increments. They're going to chip it down with remote-controlled robotic chisels and cast sediment over the face of the dam as they work their way to the bottom. They also have to grade the sediment back quite a ways so that the wet slurry doesn't collapse down on them and create an unsafe situation. So you can see the staging pad, the crane, the staircase, the location of the dam itself, the active work area there in hatching, and where they're going to put a retaining dam to capture the water and pipe it around the project area. One of the items that we had to work through was a sediment transport analysis. Our major partners include the Occlutna Native Corporation and HDR. They've been doing most of the design and permitting work for us. And I want to give a shout out to Ron Benkert in the back with ADF&G. We've had really great cooperation from the agencies. Part of the reason this project has moved so rapidly is everyone's leaning forward to make this happen, and special thanks to Ron. These are the results, and I'm no sediment expert, but this is sort of the schematic of the results from the sediment transport analysis, showing how that wedge of sediment, which extends about a mile upstream of the dam, is going to move down through the system over time. We've had concerns from DOT and the railroad about their bridges downstream and how they might be impacted by that wedge of sediment. The channel downstream of the dam, as you might imagine, is scoured to bedrock, so there'll be some improvement of that habitat as the sediment fills in that bare bedrock canyon. The blue is the area that'll be eroded, so obviously the wedge above the dam will be eroded out over time, and the modeling shows within about a three-year period the fines will move on through the system out to Kinnick Arm, and there'll be some deposition in the areas in yellow near the Thunderbird Creek confluence, erosion shown in blue, and minor change in green. And if you have technical questions about the sediment transport analysis, I'd be happy to refer you to the folks at HDR who did all of that work, but it was a major component of the analysis. As I mentioned, we've moved briskly through most of the permitting. Our last major permit we applied for yesterday with the Corps of Engineers. We did have to get a permit to do in-water work this fall. We also had a permit from ADF&G. Everything's moving according to plan. Actually, we got a lot further along this year than we expected. We set a very aggressive goal and met it and under budget. So really pleased with that. We know that this is a multi-stage project. So if you drive over the Eklutna, you see this little muddy trickle running under the Glen Highway. It's not the Eklutna River. The major problem is that very little water runs down the Eklutna Canyon. Most of that water is hijacked and run through a power plant that dumps the water into the Kinnick River. So what we're looking at there is Eklutna Lake on the left and Kinnick Arm there on the right, the Eklutna River Canyon there in the middle of the photo. Most of that channel is dry. So the water that we're dealing with down near the lower dam, and by the way, the dam is off to the right. So most of that channel is dry because I'll show you the plumbing. So the dam, the lower Eklutna Dam shown there in red, the Eklutna Lake off to the right, the power plant that I mentioned has a tunnel that runs from Eklutna Lake to a power plant on the old Glen Highway where there's a tail race where the water comes out. So that's basically the Eklutna River coming out in the wrong place. Very little water escapes Eklutna Lake. Most of the time, it looks like this. There's an arrow showing where the river should be, but it isn't. And this wouldn't be allowed. If someone proposed to take all the water out of a salmon-bearing river now, it wouldn't happen. But this happened back in the 50s when people apparently didn't care. This was a federally funded power plant. It is now owned by three private power producers, MEA, Chugach, and MLMP. MLMP is the principal partner, and they received this facility pursuant to an agreement signed in 1991 by those parties, as well as the state, NOAA, and Fish and Wildlife Service, as a substitute for the FERC process, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission process. FERC was circumvented. It was kind of a nice Ted Stevens backdoor deal. And so we're calling on the agencies that signed that agreement in 1991 to act like FERC. There was a sockeye run that was lost due to this project, and we're asking for water to be put back into that river. And not just the bare minimum, not just fish flows. We want a real natural river. And I think the likely solution is to close that power project. It provides 1% of the power picture for South Central Alaska. It's outdated. It was built in the 50s. It hasn't been upgraded. And if we're going to get water back into the Eklutna, it probably means closing that power plant. So dewatering a salmon river is simply unacceptable. And my view is that any hydro project that kills salmon cannot be considered renewable energy. Thank you. Again, there are fact sheets on the table in the back near the entrance. I guess we might have time for one or two questions. Wow. We wouldn't. Actually, we have a surplus of power in the grid right now. That power plant could easily be decommissioned. That plant that you're talking about was built on Aklutna land, and so Aklutna certainly has a number of chits to call in. And, you know, I think it's really important to realize we're on Dena'ina land here, and the Dena'ina people have given a lot to the development of South Central Alaska, and I think it's really time to give back. This is something that they want. It's their river and their fish. So this is a wrong that deserves to be righted.
But first of all, I want to go through some highlights. I want to thank Dr. Schindler very kindly for his special presentation today, which I think was really an eye-opener for all of us in terms of expanding our vision or our knowledge of essential salmon habitat, and really broadened our scope of salmon habitat. Few reminders, those of you who are not going to be here tomorrow, there's symposium evaluations available at the registration decks. And if you're leaving, would you also leave your name tags there? Next, we've got two open seats on the Matsu Salmon Habitat Partnership Steering Committee, an at-large seat and a tribal seat. Also, a reminder, we have an evening lecture. Dr. Schindler is going to do another presentation, but it's going to be oriented towards the public, and you're invited to bring friends and family, and that starts at 6:30. Immediately following my little presentation here, there's a social hour, the Matsu Partnership is sponsoring appetizers prepared by Turkey Red, and then there will be a cash bar. A few reflections. I really enjoyed Christy Sincotta's opening remarks and her focus on the need for collaboration amongst all of us diverse people, agencies, our different interest groups that are involved, and in the preservation of salmon habitat. At the symposium, you know, we're all able to get together and collaborate, but then most of the time, you know, we go on our way. But I think, you know, the time's coming when we've got to be thinking more about and doing more about collaboration. Rick Renzi, the executive director from the Palmer Chamber of Commerce, struck chords with me on the economic importance of salmon. He focused on the tourism and the visitor industry, the recreation part of the salmon industry. I'm a representative of the commercial sector of the salmon industry. We take a holistic approach to the salmon industry, recognizing not only commercial, but the importance of personal use, recreational, tourism, and subsistence. To give you an example, there's 3,900 jobs between the Anchorage and the Mat-Su Valley in terms of commercial fishing. There's a $160 million payroll between Anchorage and Mat-Su. Just in the Mat-Su Valley alone, there's over 350 commercial salmon permit holders, each of which is a small business, and they employ about 200 crewmen that also live in the valley. The take-home payroll into the valley alone is $27 million, and $20 million worth of that fishing earnings go right into to Wasilla. I just want to revisit with Dr. Schindler. I thought that, and here I'll point to the map, this topographic map that was developed by the Nature Conservancy. Copies of it are available at the Nature Conservancy, and it was done by Jim Pasquale some years ago. He spent countless hours on it. I got a copy from the Nature Conservancy about 3 years ago. I took it into FedEx. I had it put on poster board and laminated, so it's almost waterproof. I take it to the Kenai Peninsula Home Builders Home Show every year. This poster draws more attention than any other exhibit that we have in our little exhibit there. People stop and look at it. They'll even come back and bring a friend with them, and they're pointing at different places on this chart. I found it to be a very important educational piece, and I think, as Jim told me, there's 50,000 miles of rivers and streams in the Mat-Su Valley. That's twice the trip around the equator. That's a lot of miles of water, and which is essentially, you know, salmon habitat waters up here in the Mat-Su. Tremendous amount of geographic and topographical diversity up here. And in closing, I'd like to just say that it's a tremendous challenge, I think, for the Mat-Su Borough and for all of us, you know, that are here and others who are concerned about preserving salmon habitat and trying to, you know, work with land development to create voluntary mechanisms if possible, you know, and to avoid regulation if possible. In other words, to sit down with industry to try to map out the future. I'd also like to just draw a quick attention to Heather Lesconek, who gave us that excellent presentation on Elodia. It's the first one I've heard, and I think she did a great job, and I'm glad that DNR is really on top of it. I was really impressed with what they're doing, and I heard a recommendation. Is there a way to create some sort of rapid response team so when you see an Elodia breakout, you know, you can get on it? Well, I guess we could support funding of that kind of a rapid response with the Alaska legislature. So anyway, last but not least, I'd like to thank the partners, the agency partners in particular that support the Mat-Su Partnership Steering Committee, because we've got NOAA, we've got actual working agency people on that steering committee that are working with these much-needed projects. We've got NOAA, we've got the Mat-Su Borough, NOAA, we've got Erica Ahman here, we've got Frankie Barker, we got Jonathan Gerken, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We've got tremendous expertise. Tracy Smith, and then last but not least, all the funding, support, and effort of the Nature Conservancy. Corrine Smith, who is leaving Nature Conservancy, but then also Jessica Speed. So thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to say a few things.